Good afternoon. My name is Regina Brink, and I am the first vice president of the California Council of the Blind, welcoming all of you to our afternoon session. This is our first general session, and I'm so glad all of you could join us. We have a few things planned at the beginning here, and then we'll be hearing from some wonderful presenters. So without any delay, we're going to hear the Pledge of Allegiance now, and join us if you'd like.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Sarah Harris. Okay, and now we have our very own Cache Wills, all the way from the East Coast, to sing our national anthem.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and the bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Cache. That was lovely. All right. Is Lisa on today? Because I have a rumor that she has some door prizes. And if she isn't on now, she will be. So stay tuned for that. We will have door prizes available. But before we do that, we're going to get into our presentations. First, we have a very welcome guest from the Department of Rehabilitation, Kim Rutledge, director now of the Department of Rehabilitation. And I had the pleasure of meeting her in person, and I believe you will enjoy her just as much as I did. I've heard her speak at Joe Xavier's retirement. And so I hope you'll enjoy meeting her. And then Sue Pelbath, who is the Deputy Director of Specialized Services. And they may have a few other staff members with them. So I will turn it over to Kim.
Thank you so much, Regina, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm so happy to be here with you all today for your virtual conference here. So as Regina mentioned, I'm Kim Rutledge, and I am the new director of the Department of Rehabilitation. I've been in the role for about exactly 3 months now, and am just really excited to be in the role and have an opportunity to spend a little bit of time with you all today and tell you all a little bit about myself as well as kind of my vision for the department and where we hope to be going in the coming months and years. I know that many of you had a long-lasting relationship with former director Joe Xavier, and you know, I spent a lot of time with him over the last year or so kind of preparing to step into this role, and know how important this community is to DOR. And first of all, just want to say that I'm committed to continuing those relationships that, you know, were established and fostered so well by Director Xavier. So just to tell you all a little bit about myself, I have been with the state of California for about 9 years, the last three of which have been at DOR. Prior to coming to DOR, I spent a number of years working in other disability programs, most notably the In-Home Supportive Services Program and Adult Protective Services Program at the Department of Social Services. But part of what motivated me to want to come to DOR is I am a person with a disability. I'm a wheelchair user and was born with my disability and have been a consumer of VR and independent living services, both off and on throughout the course of my life. And really, I see the services that we provide in this department as being critical to letting people really live their full lives. You know, I first went to VR when I was a teenager. Well, actually, it'd probably be more accurate to say they came to me. A vocational rehabilitation counselor showed up at my IEP meeting and, you know, really helped my family get connected to services so I could go to college and, you know, be able to get a college degree and pursue a career, which I proceeded to do. Then a number of years later, when I was laid off from a job and wanted to change careers, at that point I was living in California and I went to DOR and again was able to receive services to go to graduate school, get a master's degree, and do the work that I'm doing here today. So I really firsthand experienced the transformative power of our services. And you know, I know we spend a lot of time talking about employment, but really it's about whether it's jobs or housing or assistive technology or whatever it is, everything we do is really in service of making sure that people with disabilities can live the best life that they want to, however they want to. And I am committed to making sure that that continues and that the people that come through our doors receive the best services they can to live the lives they want to lead. So with that, I'm going to, I know that Sue and her team are here and have a lot of information to share with you all today. So I'm just going to take a few minutes to first kind of go over some of the initiatives that I'm working on right now around my own vision and direction for the department. Then I'll provide a few brief updates on other things going on at DOR, and then turn it over to Sue and her team. So, like I said, I wanted to start out and talk a little bit about what my goals are for the department. So right now, I really have three goals, and I'm going to talk about each of them in a little bit of detail now. The first one is increasing the number of people who leave the VR program with a job that leads to a long-term career. I think that we're all pretty aware of how in recent years, the number of individuals that we're serving throughout the department in our employment program has increased pretty dramatically. And our staffing has not necessarily kept up with that growth. So we are looking at all of this to figure out the best way to be able to move forward and address that and make sure that we're getting people through services faster, getting them, you know, signed up and into case, and making sure that people are getting the attention that they need throughout their DOR case so we get to a successful outcome in the end. So Which we're also having to figure this out right now with a lot of things going on, both with our state budget and everything going on federally, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more in a moment. But we are wanting to make sure that we are improving these outcomes with the existing resources that we have. So how I'm thinking about doing this right now and the work that we're starting right now to actually make this a reality is I've dedicated a small team of existing DOR leadership to lead the effort to increase employment outcomes and overall quality of services. We're considering a number of different options, including a possible reorganization plan, reviewing our counseling staff classifications to improve hiring, improving our onboarding and training processes for counselors, and a better communication plan to improve our community and business awareness and engagement. We're also looking at modernizing our service delivery by leveraging certain tools such as artificial intelligence to be able to allow our staff to work more quickly and effectively. This leads to really my second goal, which is modernizing a lot of our business operations, our data collection, our IT functions, and how we do communications as an entire department. So we're modernizing many of the internal tools that our staff uses for everything from their own requests for things they need to how we do our IT functions. Lots of those types of things are in the process of being modernized right now to be able to free up staff time to do other things. We're also looking to modernize our internal and external communications. You may be aware that we had an effort last year to change our department's name to something that would resonate a little bit more than rehabilitation. And unfortunately, those efforts are on hold due to some things going on in the legislature. However, we're looking to change our program naming conventions to better align with plain language that will better resonate with people with disabilities. So this may include renaming our vocational rehabilitation, specialized services, and independent living programs and divisions. Once our new program names are established with feedback from our staff, as well as stakeholders like you, the legislature, and other community partners, we will update all of our outreach and education materials, many of which have not been updated in over 15 years. And then my final goal really is improving collaboration between our employment services and our other programs, both internally and with other disability and aging programs statewide. So while here at DOR, most of our staffing and resources are directed to the vocational rehabilitation program, most individuals with disabilities really succeed in employment if they have access to the other services that we provide as well. And that includes a lot of the programs that we have for individuals who are blind or visually impaired. So like our OIB program, the OCB, and then our independent living programs otherwise. Because as I like to say, you know, having a job is great, but it's pretty hard to have a job if you don't have a roof over your head, or for many people, personal care assistance or adaptive technology or the other things that we need to do in order to be able to both work and live our lives. Additionally, many of the people who come to us need additional services that are provided either through other governmental agencies or non-governmental organizations. So we're going to really leverage our relationships and build new ones across departments and programs to ensure that everyone who comes through our doors has access to the full scope of services available to them, whether their service is necessarily at DOR or not. Because in the end, as I said, really the goal is to make sure that everyone who comes through our doors really succeeds and is able to be independent, however that looks for them. So those are really my three goals for the department and what I'm working on making sure come to reality in the coming months and years as I adjust to this new role. I'm going to move on now and talk a little bit about what is going on at a federal and state level. So that way, you know, and kind of give some context to some of these things that are going on. So first of all, I'd like to talk a little bit about the national landscape. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the president issued an executive order about a month ago now that eliminates the Department of Education federally. And the Rehabilitation Services Administration, or the RSA, and many of our other programs sit under the Federal Department of Education. So to let you know where we're at with that right now, the RSA does remain intact. Some of their staff took retirement, but there hasn't been a formal reduction in force among RSA, unlike what we've seen in many other departments and programs. We have been asked by CSAVR, our membership organization, about our opinions about whether or not, if RSA were to move, if it would move, if we would prefer to see it move under the Federal Department of Labor or the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. Most states, including California, have gotten together and discussed it and determined that we think that the Department of Labor would be a better fit for RSA at this point, partially because they already have ODEP, the Office of Disability Employment Policy, where they do other work around employment for people with disabilities, but also because we're seeing a lot of cuts specifically to people with disabilities in Health and Human Services right now. Mm-hmm. And we feel like leaning into jobs, leaning into labor and being housed there will probably be better and make more sense long run for the program. Several of us, including myself and Sue, both had the opportunity last month to attend the CSAVR conference, which is the big national conference for VR in Washington, D.C. And the new acting commissioner for RSA, Chris Pope, spoke to us. He was generally positive about the future of VR and the future of RSA. He said that while the government efficiency folks are in the building and they're asking lots of questions about the work they do, that the overall indication was more from curiosity and wanting to learn more and seeing the value in the program. And really that goes to say just to one other thing that I'm really thinking about right now, which is really leaning in all of our conversations to talking about the value of the work that we do. Because we help people get jobs. We help people get off of benefits and become more independent in society. And I think that the more that we lean into that messaging, the more it will help the longevity of our program. Even though the RSA right now appears to be intact and moving forward, we haven't been quite as lucky with the programs that fall under the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. The Administration for Community Living, which provided the funding and oversight of the Independent Living Centers, our Traumatic Brain Injury Program, and our Assistive Technology Programs, that administration has been eliminated, and thousands of people at the Federal Health and Human Services Agency have been laid off. Other programs that also impact people with disabilities, including people with IDDD, many senior programs like Meals on Wheels, Adult Protective Services, caregiver supports, a lot of these things have been upended as a result of the elimination of the Administration for Community Living. As of right now, we have not seen any impacts to the funding of the three programs that we have that sit under there, but we're still watching as this reorganization takes place. Right now, the programs that sit under DOR that were housed in the Administration for Community Living have been moved to the Administration for Children and Families, and we've also heard that that's where special education will be moving. But really, we're watching this closely also because I see this as a bigger erosion of the administrative office that was started by the Obama administration to really strengthen and consolidate aging and disability programs and resources at a federal level. So this is something that we continue to monitor closely. We're also monitoring actions federally that are happening related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. You all may be aware that over the last year, we've established a new division at DOR specifically focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we have no plans to discontinue that work. That work will continue to go. We may just talk about what DEI is a little bit differently. Instead of being diversity, inclusion, and equity, we may call it disability, employment, and independence. But just because maybe we don't say the words that seem to be triggering people right now doesn't mean that we're not committed to making sure that people who come through our doors have culturally aware and competent services and continue to have those services. We know right now that there's a lot of attacks on people, on employees with disabilities federally, attacks on people with autism, and we're really leaning into the positivity of what we bring to our programs and bring to people, and are continuing really to do work as best we can on a day-to-day basis around all of these things that are happening with that commitment to continuing to serve people. I'd like to move on to a few updates about that are happening at the state level. I know I only have a few minutes left here, but right now we are really deeply in the state budget process. With next week, we expect to see the release of the May revise of the governor's budget here at the state level. And we're also monitoring the continuing resolution for the federal budget, which is scheduled to be released on May 9th, which is a week from today. Although the May revise will give us a good idea about the budget, since it will be finalized before the continuing resolution comes out, it may change significantly depending on what's in the continuing resolution. But as of the January draft of the governor's budget, DOR had a solid framework for the coming year. However, if we see major shifts, our department might have to make major adjustments as well. We're also really preparing for a challenging budget for the next 2 years, given things that are going on federally, as well as the wildfires in Los Angeles a few months ago, both of which are taking a really large impact on the current state budget. So we're living in uncertainty for the foreseeable future, but the good news is the DOR is in a strong position to be able to weather this. We have been very successful in bringing in other sources of funding, including reallotment dollars from the VR program. And we haven't, as I mentioned in my federal updates, we haven't seen any indications as of yet that any of our grants will be cut. We also received just last week a significant cost of living adjustment to the VR grant. And we also are seeing in these leaked budget documents at the federal level a potential increase for independent living as well. So we'll be closely monitoring these things in the next few months because the budget will have a big impact on the work that we can do. Just a couple other things. At the department level, we've had, aside from having a change of director, we've had a number of other executive level vacancies. In my previous role, I was the deputy director of our Office of Legislation and Communication, so that job became vacant, and I'm very excited to announce that Dante Allen, who was the former commissioner for RSA under the Biden administration, is returning to California and will be joining DOR this coming Monday as our new deputy director of legislation and communication. We also have someone who is going through the governor appointment process right now to be the deputy director of our independent living and community access division. And we're still looking for a chief counsel. We also understand and know that many of you are concerned about our assistant deputy for our specialized services division, and we're still looking for the right person for that job as well. Just briefly, I want to touch on a couple other things that are going on right now. In the last month, we have had two big master plans at the federal level, not the federal level, at the state level that have been released. A master plan for developmental services and a master plan for career education. And both of these plans, DOR has been involved in putting together, were named in both of them, and have deliverables that we'll be working in tandem with partners throughout the state to implement. And so with that, those are the updates that I have at a department level. And at this point, I will turn it over to our Deputy Director of Specialized Services, Services, Sue Pelbath, to go into more detail with things going on in her division. So take it away, Sue.
Thank you, Kim. Everybody can hear me okay? Can you hear
me? Yes.
Okay. Wonderful. Before I get started, first of all, thank you, Kim. I know I can speak for all of the staff at DOR. We couldn't be more pleased or proud to have you as our new director. If I could, I'd just do an applause with all the listeners because you deserve it. Before I get started with some of my team leaders and some words I'd like to say, is there going to be an opportunity to take questions during this general session?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So I think if you hold your questions until my team has also presented their updates for their sections, then we can go based on time, right? What's left over, how long we can answer questions.
Yes.
And we're happy to do that. As a matter of fact, those of you who know me, I do better with Q&A than I do with just talking to people. So anyhow, okay. For those of you who may not know, I'm Sue Pelbath. I am the Deputy Director for the California DOR over the Specialized Services Division. And four of the sections in my division provide the specialized services for the folks who are blind and or low vision. I myself was not born with a disability. I actually had perfect vision until I was early, like 10-ish, 10 years old. And then I had low vision for many years. And then due to a combination of macular degeneration and retinitis pigmentosa, I became totally blind. So I was teaching in special ed during that time, my 40s. And I retired because, you know, obviously I didn't have any skills and abilities to continue that work. I also was not aware of the Department of Rehabilitation and the opportunities that were there for me to continue that work. So after retiring, had a couple years of many of you on this call, nationwide, statewide, can probably relate to that transition process that we all go through with acquired disabilities and the loss and all the psychosocial kind of emotional parts of that journey. So after a couple of years of really, really kind of sad, I ended up finding out about the Department of Rehabilitation. And this was back in 2006. So I went for services, I went back to school, and in 2014, I started my second career, third if you count raising a bunch of kids. So I started my third career with the department, and I started off in the field, in a field unit. I ended up being a counselor, and then the program manager and administrator at the Orientation Center for the Blind prior to being appointed to this position. Almost 3 years now. So again, I'm so pleased to be back with you folks. I have four of my team leaders. They're all leaders within their own sections. Some are managers, some are the actual leaders of their programs. And so within Specialized Services Division, we have the immersion program on a campus in Albany, California. It's the Orientation Center for the Blind. Folks move in there for 3 years and 3 years, 3 months, and you know, learn all those skills and abilities that we all know are necessary in order to live independently and to hopefully go back to work or to acquire employment for the first time. We also have the Business Enterprise Program. And many of you know what that program is. It's our blind vendors program in California, but it is a nationwide federal Randolph Shepherd program. Also, we have the Older Individuals Who Are Blind program with Jay Harris leading that grant program. And now, thanks to many of you on this call, and due to Assembly Bill 2480, we also serve in California folks who are under 55 who are just trying to acquire those skills and abilities to live independently. We also have our Blind Field Services Employment Section. I believe Yuki's here with us today. She's one of our team managers and our acting district administrator. And she will share with all of you the latest and greatest of getting folks employed who are blind or visually impaired. I know we're a little pressed for time, so I thought we'd start off with Jay Harris and let him give us some updates on OIB and YIB, younger folks who are blind. I forget what we actually call it now, YIB, I guess. Younger individuals who are blind, and OIB, older individuals who are blind. He can let you know where we are. And we have some real exciting news about the coverage this year with our grants. So, Jay, are you here with us?
I am.
All right.
Well, thank you, Sue, for the fantastic introduction. And, Kim, it was great hearing your update as well. I am so pleased to be here and to talk a little bit today about our older individuals who are blind and younger individuals who are blind programs, or as Sue demonstrated, our fun acronyms that you may hear throughout our presentations. So please don't be afraid to ask us if we use an acronym you're not familiar with, because sometimes we use them and forget that they're not common knowledge. So, but OIB or YIB are the way we refer to the two programs. And our competitive process netted us 15 nonprofit organizations across the state of California who provide services to our older individuals who are blind population. And so the the exciting news as of October 1st of 2023, for the first time in many years, we had statewide coverage of the for that population to receive services. So no matter what county you live in California, you had options. And the good part, I will say that we had two counties that went for quite a few years with no services available. The good part is I know I did receive calls from one of those counties during that year, and one of our organizations very generously agreed to see a person who lived in that county, because I will tell you, this group of organizations is a very, very dedicated, passionate group of folks who do their best to provide the high quality services to folks all across the state. So if you need to know more, feel free to reach out to me. I'm hoping there's a way we can make sure that our contact information is shared, but feel free to reach out. An easy one to remember might be our email address. It's OIBinfo, and then our standard Department of Rehabilitation into our emails, which is at dor.ca.gov. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out, and myself or the analyst who works with me, Lori, will get back to you about getting in touch with a program in your area if you have any questions. But the way our programs work quickly is anybody 55 or older who contacts one of our partner organizations will go through the intake process with that organization, and they will work with you to establish a plan for services and support you through the learning that you need. And they may even be able to purchase some assistive technology devices, or I remind people that AT doesn't always mean high tech, so it might be simple bump dots or a cutting guard, or safety mitts for getting stuff out of the oven when they're teaching you how to cook, if you're interested in that. So our programs offer a really wide variety of independent living skills training, orientation and mobility training, assistive technology training and devices, information and referral. There's a whole wide variety of things that they can do to support you. Many of them also offer some additional programs and services that are unique to the particular organization, because many of them receive funding from other entities that allows them to expand the scope of what they're able to do or provide. And our program for those 55 and older is open to anybody who's 55 or older and has blindness or visual impairment a condition that interferes with their activities of daily living. For the younger program, it's a little bit more complicated on the eligibility for the program, but anybody between 18 to 54, so if you're 18 years of age, all the way up to almost 55, you can be served under this program if you do not have a case open with Department of Rehabilitation and are not employed. And then the other same requirements as our older program, you must be blind or visually impaired and be able to benefit from the services. So that program's a little more restrictive because we already have a vocational rehabilitation, you know, program, Blindfield Services, that can assist folks who are looking for employment. So this program is, in many ways, people will remember back. We try not to bring up homemakers plans all the time, but this is in many ways a good way for folks who are not looking for an employment outcome to be able to get some instruction and assistance in learning new things as they adjust to living with blindness or visual impairment. So, and again, that program is available across the entirety of the state as well. The referrals are the same. So every program that has an OIB program, every organization that has an OIB program also has a YIB program. And they may call them something unique. The programs often name the programs at their organization, but if you call, you should be able to talk with them and you know, see what their requirements are and set up an intake and so on. So I'll wrap it up there and look forward to any questions folks might have.
All right, thank you, Jay.
Great, and we have lots to share, but we're all here. Contact us, like Jay said, and we'll continue to provide anybody with more information after this conference. Next up, we're going to have Kelly Snow. He is our program administrator over the Business Enterprise Program, and he'll be giving you a brief overview of what's happening there and kind of how our vendors are doing. So, Kelly, are you with us? I do not hear Kelly.
Uh-oh. I don't hear him. Do we see him, Natalie?
No, he's not on the attendee side. Unless he has a phone number. Would he come in on a phone, do you think?
It's possible. And if he's hearing us.
Kelly, raise your hand.
We do have a phone number of 626.
No.
And 680. Oh. Okay, never mind. Sorry. Well, let me see. Hold on.
Don't read that phone number out loud. Thank you. Okay, well,
For housekeeping purposes, this is Jay. I'm wondering if you may want to, if somebody knows what the command is to unmute on the phone, because that I know can be.
I have to give them permission to do it, because it's a webinar. So, yep.
Yeah, he has to join on his panel link. In case you're listening, Kelly. All right. We will move right along here, and we will listen to Kerry Stamps. He is our program manager at the Orientation Center for the Blind, the campus I was talking about briefly earlier. And there is an administrator, Eric Mazaregos, who's off this weekend. So Kerry has a position I formerly had at OCB as well, and he's going to give us the latest and greatest from OCB.
Thanks, Carrie.
All right, we hear you fine. Thank you.
Oh, good. Thanks. Yeah. And thanks to you, Kim, as well. So OCB, we've been here since about 1964, so it's been in the community a long time. We're in Albany, California, and we're currently a three-month cohort program. So we have four cohorts per year. So you said 3 years by accident. I think it feels like 3 years to some of our students, but you know, they learn a lot in a very short period of time. It's a pre-vocational program under DOR, so we're the only property owned and operated by the Department of Rehabilitation. So the DOR counselors in the field, they refer their consumers here for pre-vocational skills training. And we train across five different domains. So we teach computers and assistive technology. So students are learning how to sharpen their computer and typing skills, learning JAWS, Zoom Text, Fusion, things like that. they learn Braille. So we have some advanced Braille users come in, and we have people who've never touched a Braille cell in their lives. We also teach orientation and mobility, which is, of course, very important for pre-vocational work in school, daily living skills and cooking as well. So non-visual techniques and learning how to, you know, keep a space clean, like an apartment or a kitchen, and safe techniques for cooking, like cutting, measuring, being around a stove. We have, you have to be 18 years old at least to get into our program. And we have anyone from 18 years old. I think in our current cohort, we have our oldest members 83, and we have everything in between. So we get consumers from all across California, from different socioeconomic, cultural backgrounds. So we have quite a mix of people coming in every 3 months. Sometimes we can extend the program for people who may be a little more new to their blindness. So maybe they need a little more skills training. If we have room available in our cohort, we can possibly extend, but this is on a case-by-case basis. Typically, we have 15 to 16 students each cohort. They have their own dorm room, single occupancy. It used to be a longer program, so OCB used to be a nine-month program, and we would have two students share a dorm room. So we've kind of dialed it back, but the students get a lot more training in a shorter period of time. So they get computers every day, 5 days a week. They get Braille 5 days a week. They get O&M 5 days a week, and then cooking and DLS, you know, depending on what they need, they will get that a few days a week. And classes are about 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day, 5 days a week. So I would say it's kind of analogous to taking a really full course load at community college. So after students leave here at OCB, they work on their individualized goals or their IP, their plan for employment. So we have a community resource navigator here that we hired 6 months ago, and she works with them on an individualized basis to not only make sure they're making good progress through OCB, but that, you know, they have a plan for after OCB. For some people, this might be mean going to community college for the first time, or it might be an older individual who can't do the kind of work they used to do before, and now they have to reinvent themselves. So she helps to guide them through that process. That was my former job as the rehabilitation counselor, and then I became the assistant administrator in the past year. In addition to all that, we offer some assessments. So we have an O&M mobility boot camp. So maybe somebody just needs to update their orientation and mobility skills so they can come to OCB for a period of 2 weeks, stay in the dorms, and they can just work on mobility and nothing else. So maybe that's somebody who's going to go to school, return to school, return to work, and they really need to get those public transportation and those white cane skills down. So they come here for a period of 2 weeks. We try to build a little fun in as well. So we do some field trips with the students. We'll take them over to Muir Woods or down to the Berkeley Marina. There's also a blind sailing program for the San Francisco Bay. So we have a partnership with them where they come and pick up students here at OCB, and they'll take them out to the Berkeley Marina and teach them how to sail, which has been pretty fun for them. We also partner with a organization called Kid Power, and they provide self-defense training. We do once a year. We'll do like an in-person self-defense training, but they also do training around workplace etiquette, how to stay safe out in public, what to do if somebody's confronting you out on the street. So every cohort, there's at least one or two of those meetings online so that those students can benefit from that training. Regarding the BEP program, we will do an assessment for BEP as well. So if somebody is considering the BEP program, the counselor is not quite sure of their current skill set, they'll send them here to OCB for a week and we'll assess where they're at. We don't really provide training during that time, but we just kind of assess where they're at in their computer skills, with their Braille skills or organizational skills, and then we provide a report to those counselors in the field. If a counselor isn't quite sure that a consumer is ready to come to OCB at all, they can also send them to us for a week, and we can kind of assess and see, okay, is this person ready for an intensive training program, which it is. You know, for 3 months, you're here, you're in classes every day, and, you know, maybe somebody is really new to their visual impairment. So maybe they're not quite ready, but the counselor wants to kind of get an assessment of where they're at. So we also do that for the counselors. Lastly, I would like to mention that we partnered this year with an organization called Hearts for Sight, which provides actual therapy services for our student population. And this has been enormously beneficial because coming to OCB, you know, you're meeting large groups of new people, you're in an intensive, you know, classroom environment, you're having to navigate socially, maybe you haven't had to do that for a while. And so you might need some counseling, especially in those first couple of weeks. So I'm able to refer, and our community resource navigator is able to refer those students for counseling. So they get 8 sessions while they're here at OCB to help them adjust to their visual impairment. And at times we've been able to extend that as well. So I think that's about all I have right now. So Sue, I think I'll give it back to you, and thank you all for coming, and thank you for hosting.
And if I could say, that's amazing. I am glad the counseling has been added to programs.
Yeah,
and I saw Kelly Snow enter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I saw Kelly Snow enter. By the way,
he did. I heard that announcement as well. Thank you so much, Carrie. That was really great overview. So much is happening at OCB, and to put it in such a short period of time, but it's really exciting. We've been able to really get innovative there and bring on some special programs that are applicable to living and working safely, you know, in our communities, as that is different from the way it used to be at OCB, right? Also, the 3-month cohort, the group of people is smaller. It used to be 35 people. We're down to 15, 16 for 3 months, and all of them get class mobility every day, Braille every day, computers every day, and we mimic the work day. So it's a 40-hour work week, but it's training. So I always told the students, you know, this is your job right now, and your paycheck is the training. And, you know, and it's really fun. And, you know, so we all know, many of us on this call know that, you know, maybe we don't, the first try, we don't get through it, or we're just not quite there with the emotional part. And some of you know my story. I had 2 years of that kind of counseling thing going on before I went back for services. So, Carrie, it's awesome. I love what we're doing there. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sue.
All right. I heard that Kelly Snow is with us. He is our administrator, as I mentioned, over the BEP program. That's kind of redundant, the Business Enterprise program. So, Kelly, can you unmute and join us?
Hello. Yes. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can. Great. Hey, Kelly. It's all yours. Brief overview. All right.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Glad to be here. Most of you may know, the BEP program has sort of been on a bit of a hiatus for several years since COVID, and we're just now sort of getting back into things, getting our training geared back up. We hired a new trainer, and he just went through OCB, went through a week of training there. And he's continuing to do training to get geared up to start his first class. We're not quite sure when that will be, but we think it will be probably sometime in late summer, early fall. And we're happy to get that going once again. We provide food services, of course, to people who are in federal and state buildings, and our vendors have to be visually impaired, be legally blind in order to become a licensed blind vendor, and a client of the Department of Rehabilitation, and they need to be able to be appropriate for self-employment, because that's what this is. It's really a self-employment plan. And we send them through what is probably going to be 4 to 6 months of training, and that has varied over the years from as many as 8 months to 3 months of training. But I think we're going to look at a 4 to 6 month training program. And, you know, we really depend on the counselors to be able to determine, do all the stuff that they do to make sure that they're qualified to be a BEP vendor, and send them through our prerequisite training program, a 20-day eval with one of our vendors, for example, that's part of it, of the prerequisites to get into the training program. And currently, we have 51 primary locations with about as many as, I think we're up to about 250 satellite sites, when you include the primaries and the satellites and the interim locations that we have in the federal and state buildings, roadside rests, vending machine operations at roadside rests, prisons, United States post offices, and even the Department of Defense. We have large military contracts throughout California. We have seven of those, where they're providing dining services to our troops. So one of the prerequisites, that was hit on with the OCB presentation, but our vendors go through the OCB program as well to make sure that they have the independent living skills to to be able to participate in such a program, where they have to do, come to class every day, get to their locations where they're going to do their on-the-job training and that sort of thing. Once they go through that whole training process, they become a licensed vendor. They get a license, and then they are eligible to apply for those locations that we solicit. And they can apply for those. And if they get one of the locations, then their first inventory is sponsored by the Department of Rehab. They pay for all of that. After that's been expired, they have to buy their own inventory, and their workers' comp and liability is also paid for the first 6 months. And after that, they're on their own. And they get business consulting services from our business consultants. And so that's always, of course, available to them. We have an office in Los Angeles and Sacramento. We have four BECs, Business Enterprise Consultants, in Los Angeles, and three up here in the north in Sacramento. And they service all the way from from Sacramento all the way down to the border down south. So we cover a wide area. That sort of sums up the BEP. I don't know if anyone has questions, but.
Yep. Thank you, Kelly. We're going to take questions after we hear from our last presenter from my division, and then depending on the question, if it's for BEP, you'll take that one, okay? Thank you so much. The BEP is so complex, and so there's so much to it, and many of you do know the program, but for Kelly to be able to summarize it in a couple minutes is kind of a miracle, because it is a lot, and we are statewide, and we're busy. My team, to keep that program going and to support those vendors, work a lot. I mean, we're all on it. We were wondering how many of us support the team, and it's quite a few people. Probably around 30 folks between us and the department supports. So, and it's always unique experience, I'll tell you. It's interesting, and we welcome new consumers. So any of you out there know of someone or are interested yourself, you can get them, have them get in touch with their counselor or Kelly, and we'll take it from there. So thanks so much. Now we have Yuki Long. She is our acting district administrator for Blindfield Services right now. And Yuki's with us to talk about some of the data and share with you some numbers regarding our consumers who are in employment plans. So Yuki, you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. It's all yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. Good afternoon, everybody. And I apologize, I have a cough drop because I have a really bad sore throat. So I have a cough drop in my mouth, so I apologize. My name is Yuki Long, and I am the TM for the Inland Empire. And currently, I am acting DA for this month. And just a quick background about myself, I've been with Blindfield Services for 15 years, and I've been the manager for the Inland Empire District for about 9 years. Prior to that, I was a school counselor for at-risk youth, but I am glad to be here. I love BFS, and I just want to say that Carrie and, oh my God, Jay, I'm so sorry, Carrie, Eric, and Jay. Their programs are amazing resources, and they really greatly help our consumers. So I just want to say thank you for that, and also BEP is an amazing resource and program as well. So I am here just to give some data and updates in regards to what our the BFS is doing. First of all, our staff and our managers are working very hard to provide services and resources to consumers who are blind and low vision. And, you know, they're doing everything they can and working relentlessly to provide employment services and to get people employed into the competitive integrated employment. So that being said, I'm going to provide some data from January 1st through March 31st. The data was gathered from AWARE and the DOR dashboard. So BFS statistics for state fiscal year to date, 24-25 for the third quarter. The total applications as of March 31st was 352. The applications as of the same date in last year was 331, so we are higher this year. And applications as of the date in 2023 was 284. So that's a huge jump, so that's really great. Services to students with disabilities. Now, again, the term students with disabilities in general is anybody with a disability in a secondary, post-secondary, or other recognized education program who is 16 to 21. The students with disability applications, total numbers, as of March 31st is 40, or 11.36% of the total numbers of applications. Students with disabilities as of the same date last year was 44, or 13.29% of the total applications. Total number of individuals served this quarter is 4,283. The wage data. So this information covers January 1st through March 31st, 2025. BFS has the highest hourly wage at $29.65 per hour. The state average is $23.48 per hour. I can't do math very well, so I can't tell you what that whole difference is. So I apologize for that. I hope you guys all have your calculators up for that one. The median wage, the median hourly wage for BFS was $23.04. The statewide median hourly wage was $20. So that one is a $3.04 difference. I could do that math. That one was just super easy. The average hours worked per week for BFS was 33 hours. The statewide average per week was also 33. The median hours worked per week for BFS was 40, and the statewide median hours was also 40. So the total successful closures as of March 31st, meaning these people were employed, they're doing well, we were able to close them successfully, was 91. As successful closures as of the same date last year, of March 31st, 2024, was 86. So we are higher this year. And again, the year's not over yet, so we're hoping to capture a lot more employed consumers. Successful closure information. So placements earning $25 per hour or more. I'll give you guys the top five that we have. So we had an environmental scientist and specialist, including health. They were $76.92 per hour, 40 hours per week. I'm really jealous because I would like that as well. Lawyer, $75 per hour, 40 hours per week. Human resources, training and labor relations specialist was $71.88 per hour at 40 hours per week. Technical writer, we had $64.90 per hour, 40 hours per week. and computer programmer was at $62.50 per hour at 40 hours per week. So those were some of our highest grossing salaries for this year. And because of time, I won't go through. We have a lot more that were over the $25 an hour. I won't go over that right now due to the time. But again, if you guys want that information, you can ask Sue.
All right. So thank you guys. Ask you.
Sure. Okay. And thank you guys again for allowing me to be here to present.
Thank you.
Back to you, Sue.
All right. Thanks so much. So I think we have about 15 minutes left, and we're all here to answer anything. Kim's still with us as well. So I think we welcome questions. If we can't get to the answer, we'll get back to you. So Regina, are you going to take the lead on the question Q&A?
Natalie will recognize okay. hands.
All right. And we also have some questions by email.
Okay, we'll take a couple hands and then do a couple by email, Steve.
All right, so we're going to have Mitch, who is going to be followed by Margie.
Good afternoon. This is Mitch Pomerantz, and I have two questions.
Hi, Mitch.
The first one is that I read a couple of weeks ago something that led me to believe that there is a effort now to have some of our BFS counselors now begin to take generalist cases as well. If that is the case, that is in direct violation of SB 105, something that I was intimately involved with 20-plus years ago. Mm-hmm. And so my first question is that in the works? And if so, you really need to look at that legislation.
Yeah, I'm going
to
take a short nap, you know.
Oh, Rob, you're not muted, Rob.
Oh, okay. Is that Mark? Hello.
Okay. Hey, Mitch. I heard you. This is Sue. Sue Palbeth.
That's my first question. Do you want my second question?
Sure.
Sue or all right. My second question is that our CCB president just resigned within the last week.
I'm muted.
Takes position with,
you're not muted.
Within the Department of Rehab. And
I'm sorry, Mitch. I really hate to interrupt you. Natalie, can you get that?
Yeah, I'm trying to find them.
Rob second. Turner.
All right. Can I continue?
One moment. If you talk, it kind of jumps the screen.
Let's see. One second, guys. Sorry.
It's embarrassing. I don't know why it keeps on unmute.
I got it. Sorry. Go ahead, Mitch.
All right, Mitch. Go ahead.
All right, Mitch.
We good to go. And so our president, Sarah Harris, resigned within the last week or two to take a position with the Department of Rehab. It appeared as if she was required to do so in order to take the position with the department. We've had in the past CCB leaders, elected and otherwise, who held very high positions in the department. And if, in fact, Sarah was required to resign her presidency, that is probably in violation of state law. So I hope the answer to both questions is no, but those were my questions, and I'd like responses, please.
Okay, so the second one, I believe that was Sarah's choice. She's taken on a huge position with the department. By the way, this is Sue again, for all of you who don't know. And she and I have communicated frequently. This is a big, huge undertaking and a huge career change for her. And I think she, and I don't want to speak any more for her than that, but definitely her choice. Okay. As for the first question, now, our Blindfield Services staff are assisting the VRED caseloads, but by no means have we limited them or have denied any services for the blind consumers who come in. As a matter of fact, that's a priority. Some of the caseloads within BFS have been really low, and instead of making that workforce, if you will, that is the specialized services, you know, for blind folks, smaller, and moving QRPs over to the VRED side, we took a hard look at the numbers, and some of our counselors out there are supporting their local VR teams. So we aren't, nothing's changed to the specialized services piece, and the counselors who work for BFS are the specialists for blind field services. Does that answer the question? I hope so.
Well, okay. I'll just say very quickly, Sue, that I think it's still a violation of SB 105, and I would urge you and others in the department to take a really close look at that, because it's sort of the beginning of the slippery slope. So that's all I'll say, and open it up, and other folks can respond.
All right. Appreciate that.
Okay. We're going to move on to Margie.
Thank you. And hello, Team Rehab. Yay.
Hey Margie.
My question is actually for Kim. Hello, Kim.
Hello.
Just this week, within the last year, I got my fourth referral, and these are various sources of continued employment cases, people who are new to blindness. And in all of these cases, they have been so badly mismanaged by the counselor. I'm involved in two of the cases, about to be involved in three of them. And once I got involved, things turned around. I don't want to get into a lot of details. I suspect this is a problem system-wide, but I'm going to give you one example. I have a brand new employment case, job retention. That's the word. Sorry, with my brain injury, I forget words. Job retention. The goal, the very first goal in the rehab plan is resume writing. And that does not fit.
You and others in the department take a really close look at that, because
Mitch,
you're unmuted.
All right. Appreciate that.
Okay. We're going to move on to Margie.
Okay.
Thank you.
And hello, Team Rehab. Yay.
Someone's unmuted. I'm so sorry.
Hey, my question is actually for Kim. Hello, Kim. Why am I recording? The recording's coming through on here.
That's right.
Let's be quiet for a minute.
Within the last year, I got my fourth referral.
Oh, perhaps
and these are
the
various
streamer?
Sources. Our streamer. Excuse me. Of continued employment cases. People who are new to blindness. That's not me talking.
And no, I've been one
all
moment,
of
Margie.
These cases. They have been so badly mismanaged by the counselor.
Is someone getting that
I'm
recording?
Yes,
I'm looking.
Okay,
I'm
three of them.
It's
and
Maureen.
Once I got involved, things turned around. I don't want to get into a lot of details. I suspect this is a problem system-wide, but I'm going to give you one example.
It's not showing me who it is.
It sounds like the streamer.
Sorry, with my brain injury, I forget words. Job retention.
Can
the goal,
someone get a hold
the
of
the first goal in the rehab plan is resume.
There we go. All right.
Thank you. Okay, I'm so sorry. I apologize. And
not a problem.
Was the question clear, or were you done, Margie?
I'm just going to add to the end. Thank you, Regina. I suspect there's many, many more of these cases, and I don't want to prioritize, but I am. I think the highest priority is to keep a newly blind person, someone new to sight loss, on their job. And to me, the very first thing would be an on-the-job assessment once a plan is signed. So, Kim, I would like you to address it. Sue and I've had some conversations, and I'm going to shut up and let you cover that, please.
Thank you. Yeah, if possible, keep the question short as you can. Okay, go ahead, Kim.
All right. Happy to take that. And thank you for the question, Margie. I really think that this kind of goes back to what I was talking about during my presentation, that we're seeing across the board with people who are entering VR, whether it's through blind field services or through the general program, that we But yeah, the we're not doing as good of a job serving individuals as we can, which is why we're looking at our caseload sizes, why we're looking at the structure of the department, why we're looking at a number of these different things to make sure that we're serving people better. And, you know, either, like you said, you know, if someone loses their sight, keeping them in a job or getting somebody, you know, whatever they need when they get to us, you know, as quickly and effectively as possible. And I recognize that that is not fully happening right now. And that's why we're revisiting all of these things. And I know that that's kind of a vague answer right now, but just to remind you all, I've only been in the job 3 months. I'm still, you know, every day kind of uncovering where new problems and issues are, and we'll continue to do so. But yeah, we understand, and I'm very aware that, you know, a lot of people who are entering into program and into plan are not getting necessarily what they need as quickly and effectively as they need it. That's part of what we're going to be working on.
Are we out of time?
No, we have a few more minutes, okay. But we do want to get to the people on email.
Did you have anything you wanted to add, Sue?
I was just going to say, at this moment, I had Yuki and her team pull some data. We're around 180 job retention cases right now in BFS, and we appreciate hearing if there are issues. So continue to let us know, Margie, and Margie and I have spoken about a couple of these. So thanks.
As soon as I have the release, I will let you know about these clients. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Sue. All right, Steve.
Yeah, we have a question emailed in from Bob Acosta, who says, congratulations on your appointment as the director of the Department of Rehabilitation. In November of 2024, we learned that your blind clients were to be shifted to generalist counselors. Traditionally, it has been the belief of the organized blind that the best counselors for our blind are blind persons who have lived their lives as blind persons. Can you please explain the logic behind this decision?
I'll take it, Kim. You want me to? I'm sorry, but you have you're misinformed. That information is incorrect. All of our blind consumers have specialized counselors in blind field services. Once in a while, we'll have someone who is deafblind, and it's determined how we serve those folks best. Sometimes the teams get together. But as far as us sending our blind consumers to the regular VRED, the Voc Rehab Employment Division, that is incorrect, not true. Appreciate the question.
Thank you. And do we have another one from email?
That's the only one from email so far.
Okay, we can take one more raised hand, Natalie.
Okay, Mary Lou. You should be able to talk. You are still muted. I have asked you to unmute. All right, you have one more. Edward, let me... One moment, let me... All right, Edward,
are blind persons who have lived as blind persons.
Okay, can you please explain that might be the background
logic behind this decision?
Ed, if you can ask a question, you'll have to go to another room.
You have you're misinformed. That background is incorrect. All of our blind consumers have specialized
Mary Lou. It's Mary Lou.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Once in a while, we'll have someone who is deafblind.
Sorry, Mary Lou. Too much background noise.
It's the teams together, but as far as
okay,
so there you go.
I'm here. I don't hear it now.
Right. Okay. So if you're talking, to be clear, you have to have your radio or other device turned down, or else it
realize that.
Okay.
Streamer was doing that. Anyhow, this is Ed Crespin and Sue. I'm retired after 32 years. And I have three concerns. Recently, maybe about a month and a half ago or a month, I heard that the business enterprise program in another state, I think it was a southern state, was going to pass a state law to introduce other disabilities or other persons interested in BEP wanting to be in that program. And the Randolph-Shepard Act basically is for people who are blind. And I want to make sure Department of Rehab make sure that's still intact and they don't need you that.
It is intact. I'll just take that one first. It is intact in California. I had not heard that. And I was just at NCSAB and none of the states shared those changes. And I'm not even sure that a state law, whether it's Senate bill or Assembly bill, could supersede a federal law, the Randolph-Shepard. But in California, we are completely intact and following the same regulations, policies that we always have.
Good, because there's private industries that want to take into BEP, like at the VA hospital, Loma Linda should be a BEP location. Patton State Hospital should be a BEP location. And what's Canteen is getting in there and taking over these locations. So again, rehab needs to really make sure that BEP is protected. And my last question is, as a counselor, I had about two, maybe three BEP counselors reapplying to the Department of Rehab because BEP wasn't supporting purchasing equipment, whether it's a computer equipment or other equipment. And that really needs to be turned into BEP for BEP to provide those services and provide that equipment rather than having the person apply to Department of Rehab as a new consumer. That's my concerns.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, too. And I can just say to all of you that there are regulations on how we can spend the money and the VR dollars and also the match dollars with purchases for the BEP program come from the vendor's profits. So often we will recommend that somebody go to the field and get a counselor. And again, like Marjorie brought up, those will be job retention cases to support someone being able to stay in business and stay employed.
So, however, in the cases that I had, it was the funding was passed back and forth. They said, well, BEP should pay for that. No DOR should pay for that. The vendor finally just gave up in one situation and said, forget it. I'm not going to do it. Okay. So it's kind of sad.
Yeah, in the future, if anyone knows that, reach out to Kelly or I, and we'll look into it a little more. But I appreciate all this. We're going to, take what you've all shared with us today and take a look. And then, of course, if you know of something specific, we're happy to take that on as well.
Okay, and thank you. I really hate to cut the question and answer off, but we will have to. I want to thank Kim, Sue, Jay, Carrie, Kelly, and Yuki. It's been a wonderful presentation, and thank you for being here. A very thorough presentation. And Jeff Tom, if he's here and can raise his hand, he had something to read as well. Is Jeff here?
This is Yuki. His hand is raised.
Okay.
Jeff Tom's hand is raised.
Can you send him to unmute, Natalie?
Yeah, he can unmute. He can unmute. He's on the panelist side, so
okay.
He should be able to.
Unmute yourself, Jeff.
Steve, do you have resolution number one recorded there that you can play real quickly?
I'm sorry, Jeff. None of them have been recorded yet.
Do you have it on your Braille device that you can?
Yes, I could. If you can give me just a moment, I'm sorry. Let me grab that resolution number one.
Mm-hmm.
Just a moment.
Does this pertain to the DOR teams, or should my?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. It is, that's why we're reading it.
Okay,
thank you, President.
And in fact, it has to do with the question that Mitch raised.
Yeah. I do want to thank you for tolerating our technical difficulties. It's always hard to predict what's going to happen when you're on Zoom.
Well, we all go through it, and we all empathize for you all. I heard you all stressing. We've all been there, I'm sure.
Okay, I've got the resolution, Jeff. Number one.
Right ahead.
Okay, upholding blind services and competitive employment at the California Department of Rehabilitation. whereas SB 105 was implemented in 2003 to establish a specialized services division at the Department of Rehabilitation, DOR, with this division to include programs that serve people who are blind or have low vision, and whereas the intent underlying SB 105 was to improve upon upon competitive employment outcomes for people who are blind or have low vision, and whereas SB 105 states the department needs to implement policy and procedural changes in order to improve its ability to increase the numbers of blind and visually impaired consumers placed in competitive employment, and whereas on November 14, 2024, it was stated at a meeting of the Blind Advisory Committee, BAC, that the data for annual competitive employment outcomes for DOR consumers who are blind has essentially remained the same over time, from 300 to 400 per year. And whereas competitive employment outcomes at the DOR are negatively affected by a myriad of related challenges, including but not limited to all of the following: the database is not readily accessible and is tedious for blind and low vision users. The current procurement process is ineffective and cumbersome, which prevents consumers from receiving their technology to go to school and work in a timely manner. The current system is inadequately staffed to directly serve consumers who are blind, have low vision, or deafblind. It takes twice as long to serve a consumer who is blind, low vision, or deafblind as compared to the vast majority of consumers on a generalist caseload, as verified by vocational counselors who have served both caseloads. And whereas at the November 14th meeting, it was announced that generalist cases are being merged with the blind caseload, a decision that will further adversely impact the department's ability to improve competitive employment outcomes for DOR consumers who are blind or have low vision. Therefore, be it resolved by the California Council of the Blind and convention assembled virtually, that this organization calls upon the DOR to uphold the letter and the spirit of the law by resolving and addressing the myriad issues that hinder increasing competitive employment outcomes for people who are blind or have low vision, including removing generalist cases from the caseloads of vocational counselors for the blind, and be it further resolved that the DOR develop in an expeditious manner a plan to address the concerns set forth in this resolution and provide a copy of this plan to the organization, and be it further resolved that this resolution be sent to the Director of the Department of Rehabilitation as well as to the Governor's Office for purposes of oversight and the resolution.
So as you can see, Kim, and the resolution will be formally voted on Sunday, but as you can see, we are very concerned with the need to increase positive outcomes for blind clients, and we certainly aren't going to increase them by doing things such as enlarging our already busy BFS counselor caseloads. So we would urge you to reconsider that step that has been taken, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff and Steve.
Thank you. And a copy of that will be sent. This is Kim. I'm sorry. Thank you, Jeff. A copy of that will be sent to me and Sue, correct?
Correct. Once it's voted upon.
Okay.
And passed. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking out time from your busy afternoon.
All right. Our pleasure. Thanks so much for having all of us. Take care, everybody.
All right. And because we're running a little behind on time, we're going to go on ahead to our road to statewide paratransit eligibility. And we have Jillian Gillette, Division Chief Caltrans and Program Manager, Policy Analyst, and then he will be presenting this to us. Gillian, I think I heard you arrive.
You did. Thank you so much for this opportunity. So hello, I'm Gillian Gillette. I'm the Division Chief for the Division of Data and Digital Services at the State Department of Transportation, which is Caltrans. And I also run something called the California Integrated Mobility Program. And the mobility program's job is to remove barriers between different modes of transportation and within them, starting with transit, which has a bunch of issues. So my team of data scientists and software developers and data engineers have been, and business analysts have been looking at how we can standardize transit better so that the market is sustainable and can grow. So we were assigned, so Assemblymember Lackey in 2019 wrote a Assembly Bill 1531, I think. I have to look it up. That required the California State Department of, State Transit Administration, which sits on top of Caltrans, to do an assessment of paratransit, paratransit cross-eligibility verification. And that legislation required an assessment and then required CalSTA to make recommendations. So we were here at Caltrans, were asked to do the assessment that Assemblymember Lackey requested. And that assessment was to find out of the paratransit and transit providers in the state of California, how they made known to visiting customers that they were eligible to also receive paratransit services in their service area. Because apparently a few people had been denied service. So they, in other words, they went to some part of California having been verified for eligibility for paratransit services in some other part of California, and they were denied service, which is illegal. So the assessment asked us to take a look into, like, how do you find out how to cross-verify? So the assessment methodology that we used was essentially to secret shopper all of the transit agencies. So the research was done during COVID. And so at the time, almost all of the customer service offices of the agencies were closed. And so the only way that you could communicate with a transit agency or paratransit provider was by phone or by website. So we looked at all, I can't remember the exact number, but we looked at over 250 services. There are close to 800 services in California. So we looked at over 250 services' websites and looked to answer basic questions. Could you, was there information on the website about how you could verify your eligibility if you were verified elsewhere? How easy was it to find that information? And then was that could you act on that information electronically, or what would you have to do? And then we followed up by also asking those questions via telephone of, I don't know, another 20 agencies. So the results are published on our website. I can put a link in the chat. The findings were pretty grim, frankly. The findings were that lots of the websites don't really work well at all. And it's very difficult to find information. On very few agencies can you find cross-eligibility verification. And in fact, on most agencies' websites, it's actually pretty difficult to find information about how to verify yourself for, you know, if you're a resident in that service area. Generally, agencies, if they did have some kind of web presence, internet presence, would offer forms, PDF forms that you could, if you had a printer at home, you could download them and fill them out, but then you still had to bring them into the agency's office. Nobody had a fully online process. The data also showed that the Bay Area does this well. And you can see that there's a lot of cross eligibility in the Bay Area. And that's because the Metropolitan Transportation Commission in the Bay Area maintains a database that all the operators share. So if somebody presents their credential and asks for service coming from a different Bay Area agency, that responding agency just looks it up in the data, looks that person up in the database and verifies and then provides the service. But that's the only place in California where that exists. So we made a bunch of soft recommendations for CalSTA to consider in our assessment. And those were, first of all, you sort of in importance, first of all, that somebody, probably Caltrans, requested to create a statewide database, a la what the MTC has created, in order to kind of give the tools for agencies to do this, at scale. The second recommendation was to make the information really clear on their websites, and to make the information sort of clear and consistent across all websites. So customers should basically be able to find the same tab on everybody's website and know that that's where they're going to find information about paratransit eligibility. A recommendation that the industry work towards web forms and an automated process rather than requiring customers to print out PDFs and then bring them into offices. We forwarded the assessment to CalSTA. I don't believe that there was ever a report back to the legislature. So that's the most I can tell you about what happened with that. But I'm happy to share the assessment that we did and the underlying legislation. Let's see, what else? So that's some documented data. What I can say is that Caltrans actually knows relatively little about straight up paratransit, because we operate a sort of complaint driven system. In other words, a service can apply to us, Caltrans, for funding for paratransit services, and we fund both agencies and nonprofits. But we don't have a comprehensive list of all of the service providers in the state of California. So we only know about you if you've applied. And there's a lot of volatility in this space, meaning a nonprofit, for instance, it's generally the nonprofits, will apply 1 year and then not the next. There's a lot of turnover. The staffing at a lot of these agencies is so new and maybe doesn't have the capacity that, in fact, the Caltrans team that runs that program generally makes the application for you once they've confirmed that you're a legitimate applicant. So the upshot is that we really don't know all of the service providers in the state of California. And my team is embarking on research to discover that, so that we have a comprehensive list and then figure out a way to keep it current, because new services arrive or older ones die and they don't necessarily tell us. And we would need something like that in order to create a statewide database that everybody could use. Mm-hmm. Please, do you have a question?
No, go ahead.
Oh, thanks. Then what else? The quality of the websites is a really big issue. The internet standards are, and mobile standards are some of the highest quality standards for the disability community. The phone is the iPhone and Android devices are really a gift to all of us in so many ways. And internet protocols are like that too. So the fact that this industry is kind of homegrown and doesn't use the web is, in my opinion, really a basic problem here that we need to make sure that the transit agencies have high-performing or sufficiently high-performing websites. And the reason I say that is that the way that fixed route transit works in terms of discoverability is that if you are like most citizens of the world, you plan your trips using Google Maps or Apple Maps. And the reason that you can plan a transit trip, you know, a trip via transit on Google Maps is that fixed route agencies present their schedule and price information using a data standard. And if the agency properly does that, then Google and Apple just vacuum up that data, and that's what they use to help present it, build a transit trip option. And we spend a lot of time on my team getting all the California fixed route agencies to get religion about this mobility data standard, which is called GTFS, the General Transit Feed Specification. And so now with confidence, we can say that all of the fixed route service that's offered in California is visible on Google Maps. If there's a trip that you can't take on fixed route transit in California, it's because it doesn't exist, not because the agency hasn't gotten their stuff together in order to publish their data. However, that data standard only applies to, you know, only applies to fixed route transit. That standard, however, is extensible, meaning you can add to it, and over time it has been extended. So for instance, originally the General Transit Feed Specification didn't include the price of a trip, you know, the fare. That was added subsequently. And there is a new extension to that to make sure that customers know whether they have to pay an exact change or whether they can pay by debit or credit card. And there's a proposed, I guess it's actually adopted now, extension of GTFS called GTFS Flex, F-L-E-X. And the point of Flex is for a demand-based service, such as paratransit. And what it does is it allows a customer who would like to plan a trip using, for instance, the wheelchair symbol, to the Google Maps will present the parts of your trip. For all the parts of your trip, they will it would present you the paratransit or and on-demand options for any given leg of a trip. However, it is adopted. But only because a very small trip planner agreed to put it on their trip planner. So the transit app is a very sort of industry-friendly, darling app that allows you to plan trips. However, neither Google nor Apple voted to accept GTFS Flex because they have seen the websites of the paratransit providers. And the last thing that they want to do is use their global map product to send a customer who needs service a link to a website that doesn't work, because that makes everybody look bad. And so they voted against adopting the spec. And I understand why they did that. I wouldn't vote for it either, because my team and I have looked at the websites. You know, we need these services to professionalize more in order to provide sort of the basics of service that are required. And so I'm going to stop there because that's sort of where my team and I come from, that we would very much like paratransit to be all that it can be. But in order to be anything that it can be, it has to meet these basic minimums, which are you need to be discoverable on Google and Apple Maps. And you need to provide a kind of repeatable service that consumers expect and get on fixed route transit or get, you know, every stop sign in the United States looks the same way, right? Those kinds of standards don't really exist in paratransit, but a basic one would be GTFS Flex. and making sure that if Google or Apple identify your agency as a provider of a service in a specific area, that you know, at least there's a phone call, a phone number to call that somebody's going to pick up, or that it, you know, lands at a website that gives the customer explicit directions about how to obtain that service.
Hey, thank you. That's a lot of information. I do want to let you know that we're not using the chat feature because a lot of people
don't
access it. But
you can follow us with an email.
Great. Yeah, we will make sure people get that. And do we have, I think we have time for one question in the email and one in the room. So let's take email first, Steve, if we have anything.
We don't have any on email at this point.
Okay, one in the room.
All right. We do have Frank, and you can unmute Frank.
Hello. My question is, did your report address the completely dysfunctional process that individuals have to do in order to set up their eligibility for an out-of-town provider? You know, you would think that these people, these agencies would know each other, would have lists of who the other agencies, so that you could just call your agency and say, "Hi, I'm traveling to Los Angeles next month. Can you arrange with me to get my eligibility over there?" And instead, what my person has to do is hunt up the agency for themselves, hunt up where at the agency processes eligibility, get a fax number from that agency to know where the eligibility material is going to be faxed to, then go to your agency, find out who it is at your agency who does the faxing of the eligibility material, call them, give them the fax number of the agency that you want to send the material to, pray that they actually send the fax over, and then you have to follow up a few days later with both agencies to make sure it was actually done. What kind of a system is that in the 21st century? And was that addressed in the report?
Yeah, so absolutely. What we tried to do without calling it dysfunctional was, you know, in our methodology, we assumed that the assumption of our methodology was that someone who is qualified, is eligible in one with one provider, should be able to discover their eligibility on another provider anywhere else in the state by going to their website and getting enough, being able to get concrete information about how to do it there at a minimum. And the agencies failed that, right? You cannot find the basic information that you need to even know if there's a fax to fax problem, or, you know, like you're asking sort of a more intermediate question, which is assuming that the customer can even find out if there is a process, then the process itself is dysfunctional, right? But we started with the most basic thing, which is, you know, I'm a customer of SACRT and I have a courtesy card with my face picture on it, right? And I want to go to Eureka, right? I'm going to look up Eureka's website, you know, assuming I can find it. Is there information on Eureka's website that tells me how to share my, you know, cross-verify my registration? And the answer is no, you can't even do that. So our report addressed sort of step A, and you're asking about sort of step D. And so no, it's yes, the existing process is very consistent with a lot of American processes, which put the onus of application on the customer and not on the provider, right? It's very common in the United States that benefits programs are hard to get because the benefitee is expected to do all of the legwork, which I personally think is unfair to begin with. But that's how these processes are set up. They're not set up to be even consistent, let alone easy. And I agree, that's not the consumer's expectation, and you know, never was, but it certainly isn't today. And we should fix it. But we at the state have no jurisdiction over local agencies. All of these decisions about how to implement these things is local. So unless you carry legislation that is very clear about the outcomes that are desired, it's not going to get any better.
Thank you. And we do have just a little tiny bit of legislation that we're trying to get through just on eligibility alone, just to make, if you have a permanent or a stable disability that isn't expected to change, that you wouldn't have to keep redetermining your application, since the application process is so onerous. So
that's right. So we, for fixed route, and we'd love to extend it to paratransit if the industry were ready. So what my team and I built is, you may know that under the Federal Transit Act, the FAST Act of 2015 or 14, transit agencies that are fixed route transit agencies that receive federal money are required to give discounts to certain people. So they're required to give discounts to seniors, they're required to give discounts to Medicare card holders, and they're required to give discounts to persons with disabilities. This is above and beyond paratransit, right? You are entitled to a discount on fixed route, right? Not every trip needs to have a paratransit vehicle. So you're entitled to a discount there. But the FTA, when it enacted this legislation, didn't give any of the transit agencies a way to do it, a method or a tool. And so currently, every transit agency in the country does its own, runs its own eligibility verification process. And since they're not experts in identity or privacy, they don't really know how to design these processes. And so what we found when we did our research is that many, many transit agencies are taking photocopies of the people's driver's licenses to prove their age or their disability status. And then they're making photocopies of the driver's licenses and storing those in their offices, which is a huge violation of privacy. And so what we did was we built a piece of software that agencies that work with us can deploy that allows a customer to verify certain aspects of their identity via login.gov, which is the federal government's single sign-on system, and then associate that eligibility with their debit or credit card. And then as long as that's the debit or credit card that they want to use, then anytime they tap, they always get their discounts automatically. And if the agency next door starts to work with us at the state, then their eligibility will just roll over, so they don't have to go agency by agency. And we would very much like to work towards, you know, a consistent application period, because that's another thing, you're right, that like some agencies will only let a senior verification for 1 year, you know, because I guess you're going to get younger next year, right?
Like, yeah, I wish. Right?
Yeah, me too. As a 64-year-old, you know, like I'm looking forward to getting my discount, but not so much. Let me give you one example. So in the case of seniors, because that's the easiest one to sort of solve technically, we researched about 200 agencies in California about how they did their senior verification that you are a senior. And none of them had the same method. This is how we found out that people were taking photocopies of driver's license, for instance. And there were, of the 171 agencies, I think we researched. Just within those 171, we found 18 different definitions of senior. So what that means in California, because everything is decided locally, is that if you want to take a longer trip, or a trip to a different part of the state that has different rules, you have no way of knowing what the price is, because your senior discount will actually cost you something different on this agency versus this agency, which is a big equity issue, right? People deserve to know what the price of their trip is going to be. But the agencies neither use the same standard, and many of them don't comply with the reporting standards. So the customer doesn't know. And this is unusual in transit. So in the state of California, the Department of Food and Agriculture regulates gas stations such that if you're a gas station in California, you must have a sign on the front of your gas station which tells the consumer exactly what flavors of gas you sell and what the price per gallon is. And that information has to match what's on the pump, A. And B, the letters on those signs can be no less than 6 inches tall. Because for cars and car trips and gas, we care that the consumer knows what the price is. And that's not true in transit, nor in paratransit. So I think we have a long way to go on a bunch of these issues, but you know, you really need to start with the basics. And I hope that the information that I shared about our study shows that the basics aren't complied with. So a lot of the things that we want to do that would be really great are just not possible. You know, we have to eat our peas and carrots before we can have dessert.
I agree. And we could keep you all afternoon, but we cannot.
Thank Thanks. You, Killian. Sure. Thank you for your time.
Yes.
Cheers.
And we have a presentation coming up, but I would like to play one of our chapter of the year entrances. They'll be replayed at the banquet, but we want you to be able to hear them a couple of times. So we're going to play the first one. And while that's happening, we're going to ask Margie Donovan and Kathy Whitaker to get ready to present a couple of awards. And so we could maybe get them unmuted while we're playing the chapter of the year. Who has that? Is that this?
I have that.
Thank you so much.
So we're starting with number one. Is that right?
Correct. That's okay. A great place to start.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. Here we go.
This is President Patty from Bayview Chapter. As NCCB, many of our members are older. Some of our members were taught and mentored by some of the great leaders and founders of CCB, and we hope to gain younger folks by sharing fun and enlightening activities with others. We focus on advocacy, and because one of our members fell over a scooter, she worked very hard to bring attention to scooter safety. We value our members and we want each to be strengthened and to achieve their potential while working to support the efforts of our state CCB to promote the good of all.
Okay, thank you so much. And do we have Margie and Kathy, Natalie?
Margie's yes, ma'am. Here.
Yep, they both can talk.
Great, go ahead.
And Kathy is here.
Kathy, did you get my earlier email about the presentation today?
Yes.
Okay, good, good. So, hi, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the afternoon session. And Kathy and, I'm sorry, Richard Retta served on the CCB Awards Committee. I chaired it. And, you know, picking people for awards is not always easy. We are here today to present two Hall of Fame awards. And I'm going to ask Kathy if you would present yours first, please. Let me say one more thing. I'm sorry, Kathy. When you hear your name, if you are the recipient, please raise your hand so our Zoom host can find you. And you will have no more than 2 minutes to express your gratitude. Thank you.
Our first Hall of Fame recipient is Christy Crispin. She has been a member passionately and made significant contributions to CCB services, advocacy, and mental health support services for people who are blind and who have low vision. Her leadership has spanned several roles over the years, including CCB Board of CCB board member, chair of the scholarship committee, president of Diabetics in Action, and other activities on the local level as well. Her leadership has also impacted students, as well as veterans and Department of Rehabilitation consumers. As the Ellen Murphy Fund chair, she has helped to strengthen the protocols to support single women who are in crisis and live in California. I would like to read the plaque for Christy. 2025 CCB Hall of Fame Award is presented to Christy Crespin, who is being inducted into the CCB Hall of Fame for 54 years of unwavering dedication and significant contributions for services, advocacy, and mental health supports for people who are blind and who have low vision. Her voice and vision have helped raise consciousness and compassion within the organization. Congratulations, Christy.
And can Christy unmute?
Yep. Oh my gosh. Thank you. I'm shocked and I'm very pleased. I love helping people have better lives who live with blindness and low vision. And advocacy is what we need to do. And I believe that with CCB strengthening, we can do. And thank you so much for your confidence in me. And wow, thank you. And Ed didn't tell me.
And it's well deserved.
Very well deserved. Yes. Congratulations, Christy. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Go ahead, Kathy. Finish up.
I would actually have a second Hall of Fame award to award this afternoon as well. That is to actually Margie Donovan, an avid advocate for over 44 years in CCB. She has advocated through legislative and legal channels in support of the rights of guide dog users. She has been passionate about the ability of parents who are blind raising children and their ability to thrive. And Margie has actively supported audio description, especially in live performances. So her steadfast commitment to inclusion and justice continues to benefit generations. So happy to provide the 2025 CCB Hall of Fame Award presented to Margie Donovan, who is being conducted into the CCB Hall of Fame for 44 years of dedicated service, advocacy within CCB, a powerful voice through legislative and legal channels. Her contributions have significantly contributed to guide dog users, blind parents and their families, and expansion of audio description in live theater. Congratulations, Margie.
Yes.
I don't know.
And this is a surprise to Margie.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I have a very sneaky committee. Thank you. I'm really, really touched. And it's not fair to do it before I have to present my next award. But the council means a heck of a lot to me. We've had our challenges, but my heart has been here. This council put me on my feet as a high school student. This council has got me through a lot, and all I care about is giving back. And I will not have Kathy and Richard on my committee if I'm appointed next year. They're sneaky. Thank you so much, and thank you, CCB. In full disclosure, this next award, if I can pull it together, I'm so sorry. This next award, in full disclosure, the recipient is not aware they're receiving it. Here we go. 2025 Hall of Fame Award presented to Catherine Schmidt Whitaker.
Well, you do have a sneaking committee.
In recognition of over 30 years of devoted service and leadership in the California Council of the Blind, Catherine has, sorry, this is so hard right now. Kathy has made, I'm sorry, bear with me. Kathy has made, I can't read, I'm sorry. lasting contributions through her work on the Personnel Publication Phoenix and Scholarship Committees. Her insight helped guide organizational strategy, elevate member communications, and recognize excellence within the blind and low vision community. Kathy's unwavering commitment and collaborated spirit have been instrumental in advancing CCB's mission and empowering individuals who are blind or have low vision across California. Kathy, congratulations.
Wow. Thank you very much. I am humbled and surprised as well. I joined CCB as a college student, and I felt support and resonated and believe in the power and the mission and values of people of empowerment for people who are blind and low vision, and what CCB stands for. And I've tried to make contributions in ways that I could over the years, and will continue to do so. And thank everyone for for their support and for this recognition. And I encourage others to get involved. And even if you feel you can do a little can make a difference. We can all, each of us can make a difference in terms of the growth and spirit for people who are blind and low vision. Thank you.
Thank you,
again,
Kathy.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Margie. Congratulations.
And I just would like to close with saying, honestly, I didn't know this was happening. I said last year and I said this year, when I'm chair, you cannot nominate me. And Kathy didn't know this was happening. We had to do it this afternoon because she's going off on an anniversary trip. And thank you, Kathy. Thank you, Richard. And we will have more at the banquet. Thank you, Regina.
Okay. And in the interest of time, we're going to move along. So hold tight. Lisa has those door prizes, you guys. But we have an emergency preparedness panel, and they have been patiently waiting. It is going to be chaired by Jeff Tom. We have Georgiana Armstrong and Vance Taylor. And he's from right here in Sacramento, of course. And we have Jackie Cosi, or Tamayo. I hope I'm saying that correctly. And my Braille display is a little bit slow, but she's from San Jose. And then Jennifer Maradiaga. And she's also coming to speak to us, and I'll let them introduce themselves and not delay anymore. Take it away, Jeff.
Okay, thank you. So as Regina just stated, we have, and I won't go through everything here, but we have Georgiana Armstrong, who is the Kern County Emergency Services Manager from Bakersfield. By the way, we have a fantastic chapter down there in Bakersfield. Vance Taylor, who's Chief of Office of Access and Functional Needs in the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services. We have Jackie Cosi Tamayo, who is the Emergency Planning Coordinator for Santa Clara County Office of Emergency Management. And finally, we have Jennifer Maratiaga, and I probably butchered your name as well, Emergency Planning Coordinator for the County of Santa Clara in their Emergency Management Office. So we're going to cover two major questions today, and I hope to leave some time for questions from the audience, because this is just such an important topic. The first question, and I'm going to throw it to one really a national expert in this field, and I say that very advisedly. He is known throughout the country, and he has spoken to us before Vance Taylor. So the first question, and then others can chime in. Vance, as a transit-dependent person, or really anybody for that matter, but especially in our the guise of most of us, what do you feel that a person needs to take with them when they evacuate as a result of an emergency situation?
Yeah, no, great question, Jeff, and thanks for inviting me to be on the panel. It's great to speak at the group again. You know, in looking at the question, I think the first thing that comes to my mind is the times when I go to an emergency shelter and I'm speaking with individuals with access or functional considerations, right? Older adults, people with disabilities. What is it that they are in need of? And usually it comes down to the things that they don't think about in the moment of evacuation. It's this really, really high stress environment of, Jeff, you got to evacuate right now. The wildfire's coming. The flood waters are on their way. You got to move. It's life safety. Go, go, go. And in that moment, it's not realistic to expect that you're going to remember all the things you need. I think about when I go on a trip, I always have to make a list, right? Otherwise, I find myself on an airplane and I'm asking my wife, but what did I forget, right? I know I forgot something. And leaving for the airport's not nearly as stressful as evacuating for my life. So we talk about things like have a go bag. And yeah, you know, your go bag needs to have all sort of the standard things that they talk about, right? Some clothes, some water, some a flashlight, a radio, cell phone charger, that sort of thing. When we're talking about individuals with a variety of disabilities, we have extra considerations that we've got to account for. So, for example, medically relevant phone numbers, right? As well as our prescription medicines. I've been in a shelter and I've heard somebody say, well, I don't know what pill I take. I take a red one and an orange one. And it's like, okay, well, remember the names or the dosage. Well, one's sort of an oval shape and the other's a triangle. Okay, well, you know, let's call your doctor. Well, I've got that phone number, but I forgot my phone. Or my daughter has that. She handles that for me. And of course, that phone number is not memorized. And so those are the type of challenges of we can actually get you the prescription medicine you need, but we need to be able to speak with your medical providers. So bring medically relevant phone numbers, bring identification cards, bring a copy of your health insurance, outline any allergies, those type of things that you might have. But really, medicine, medicine, medicine. Also, if you use assistive devices or technologies, you know, a lot of people communicate using an iPad or their screen readers or other devices, bring chargers for those. I can't tell you how many times people have the resource they need in hand, but they don't have the power cord to charge it so they can utilize it. Also, the number one thing that we find that people who use power chairs forget to bring are wheelchair chargers. So it's this idea that you got to think about, well, what do I need in order to be safe and secure and independent? And make that list and have that list somewhere when, if the time comes, when you've got to evacuate in a hurry, you're not going to forget the things that are most important for your well-being. Steph, I know you have a lot of other things you want to get to, but those are just my thoughts on that topic.
Okay, any other of the panelists wish to chime in on this particular question? Okay, so thank you for that answer. And the next question, we're going to turn it over first to our county folks, and then after they've all had a chance to talk about it, then we'll get back to Vance and let him weigh in. So I don't consider myself anywhere close to an expert in this field, which I did, but I'm not. But one of the things that I have come to learn is that, in my opinion anyway, perhaps the weakest link in many of our county and local jurisdictional plans is the ability to ensure that people with access and functional needs, which include us, and most of us are not only fall into that category, but most of us are also transit dependent as well. People like us at this virtual convention here are able to be evacuated to a shelter. I personally don't know for sure how I would get evacuated. I might have a way with, you know, one of my daughters, but I'm not sure that they have kids and they have other, you know, parts of their support system that they have to deal with. So I don't even know for sure how my wife and I would get evacuated. And I've given a lot of thought to it. So if I'm in that position, then many of you are in that position as well. So my question to my panelists in Santa Clara and Kern County, and I'll let any of you start with this, is how can a county best provide in their plan for a system that will ensure that those of us who are truly transit dependent will be able to be evacuated? And I was so passionate about that question that I knocked my headphones out as soon as I said those words. So whichever one of you wants to start, go right ahead and address that very difficult question.
So I'll go ahead and begin. Thank you once again for the invitation. I am Jackie Cochitamayo, and yes, you pronounced it correctly, so thank you. And I am the program manager for the Access and Functional Needs Cultural Competency Division of our county. And it is a question that keeps coming up time to time on how do we properly evacuate if we have an access and functional need, and how does the county promote it and plan for it in the time for response. And it is a complex question, and it takes a large village. So here in Santa Clara County, we use a three-prong approach in preparing for evacuations. And it's a great question because right now we are rewriting our wildfire annex that includes evacuation and integration of access, those with access functional needs for their not only evacuation, but also when we do reentry and repopulation. And first and foremost, we do a preparedness phase and trying to teach and educate all members of our community about personal preparedness. So something that Vance was mentioning, what do I need? How do I see things? What do I have in my around my house? So when we have to go, we have that available. But on top of that is, who do I talk to? How do I go? What do I have? What transportation needs do I have available to myself? And sparking those conversations. So we talk a lot about that and working with our nonprofit organizations and our team members, both at our regional centers and independent living centers, and really start working that community of preparedness. But when we are talking about the response and how do we do it, we have an amazing access and functional needs cultural competency sub-working group, because we truly believe that we cannot plan for evacuations or anything in emergency management without you. So we really want our community to be a part of it. So we do, when we are starting the planning, we bring in groups of people. That includes our fire department, our sheriff's department, and our community members with subject matter expertise to see what are the gaps that we need to know about when it comes to evacuation. What are our routes? What's the topography of our county? So in our county, we have the valley, very flat land, but we also have mountains and windy roads, areas that are, have one egress and one ingress. So we try to actively make sure that we take those considerations when it comes into evacuation processes. And we work with transportation. Transportation is very key. So who is not only in our typical transportation authorities, but our paratransit or any private vendors who can assist with those capabilities. And one of our key groups that we have formed over the years because of all these conversations is a strong medical health group. And that medical health group, we make sure our access and functional needs coordinator is involved in those conversations, because we're not only thinking of anything that's limiting in the sense of physical disabilities, but we're thinking about proficiency in other languages, cognitive, everything under the scope of access and functional needs. So when it comes to evacuations and knowing our demographics of the area and working with our partners, we could better prepare of resources in the area. And we lead that into recovery. So we use the same thing of when it's time for us to come back from an evacuation of a certain area. How do we also provide assistance on those who may not have transportation capabilities and or need assistance? How do they get to come back home or come back to the area that they evacuated from? So these are the conversations that we do have, and we don't do it just in-house. We use our partners to make sure we have those thought-provoking questions, making sure that we try to provide solutions. And we use a lot of guidance, and Vance could tell you, we probably call him a lot too. So sorry, Vance, but we use a lot of our guidelines and guidance from Cal OES and CDC and other agencies, because we just want to make sure that when we are speaking about evacuations, because things are quickly and sometimes things change, but we have a strong foundation so we can make those decisions with our partners at that crucial time when it's time to say go.
Okay, thank you. So, Georgiana, I'm going to ask you to answer that question. Georgiana comes from a county with which has some different challenges, got some, you know, extremely well populated, densely populated urban areas with the city of Bakersfield, but it's also got a lot of rural areas as well. So, Georgiana, I'm going to turn it over to you and see what you have to say about Kern County specifically and the whole issue in general.
Thank you, Jeff. And I had a problem with my link, so you see my name is Vance Taylor. Happy to follow in his wake, as always. I'm Georgiana. And even though I work for the government, I really want to start this out by saying your best bet is to build something redundant so you are not totally reliant on the government. As Jackie mentioned, when we are in a situation where we have a fire or something going on where we're evacuating, there's a lot of moving parts. So one of the preparedness things that Kern County preaches for everybody, but especially persons with access and functional needs, is to build a support team. And that is not a buddy system. As Jeff mentioned, he's talking about how would he evacuate, and speaking about his daughter, recognizing that she has other commitments. So whether it's in your workplace or your home with your neighbors, if you could develop a cadre of people with whom you feel comfortable enough to be able to express what your needs are and explain that clearly, that is going to be helpful so you always have a first choice with government being your second choice, because government is going to be so busy. Ensuring specific response at an individual level is very hard to guarantee. You can have systems in place and you're going forth as widely as possible. But when it's your life and your safety, having that extra layer of saying, I've got multiple pathways of people that could help me, I think is to everybody's benefit. The other thing I wanted to mention specifically for this group is before you can evacuate an area, you need to evacuate from your home. And in California, obviously, we are prone to earthquakes. And so if there are persons who are blind or who have low vision, after an earthquake, you could have debris and pathways that you wouldn't expect to have there. So I would suggest, just a suggestion, and it's not specific to evacuation, but to also, in your preparedness phase, really take some time to make sure that your home is as earthquake-proof as possible, so that if you have to leave your home, you're not going to encounter barriers that you didn't expect to be there. I'd also want to recommend that in California, there are three levels of evacuation. There's shelter in place, there's evacuation warning, and there's evacuation order. Now, an evacuation warning is going to be issued at a time where it is suggested that people who will need additional time to evacuate, this is the time for them to leave. When you receive an evacuation order, that means leave right now. Danger is imminent, go now. So the time to prepare and to contact your group and to reach out for resources and to get moving is when you get that an evacuation warning. So in Kern County, what we do is I would strongly suggest that everybody reach to their local jurisdiction to make sure that you are registered to receive alerts and warnings from your local jurisdiction. In Kern County, we have a system which we call Ready Kern, which we've used for a long time. And I just have to throw in, because I'm extremely proud of, we were able to enhance the ability of our Ready Kern system, partnering with a company called Deaflink. So now when you get Ready Kern messages, there will be links to a video with our message in American Sign Language, captioned and spoken, and another link for the message in audio in spoken by a certified Spanish speaker. So I just have to say that because I promote Deaflink wherever I go. I think it's something that every jurisdiction needs, and I'm thrilled that Kern has it. When we are in an evacuation mode and we activate our Ready Kern system, within our message, we will include information that says, if you need evacuation transportation assistance, call this phone number. And that phone number is to our Aging and Adult Services Department. It's their elder abuse hotline, so it is manned 24/7, 365. We don't want people to call 911 because those numbers are going to be overrun, and we want them to call a number that's going to be picked up after a couple of rings and you're actually speaking to a person. So staff at Aging and Adult will take intake from the caller, their name, their address, any of the particulars that we need to know. Aging and Adult Services will then forward that information to emergency management up at the Emergency Operations Center, where we will also contact the constituent just to confirm you're ready to go, you want to go, we've got the right address. And once we have that confirmation, then we would deploy transportation resources. In Kern County, we work primarily with Kern Regional Transit. We also have memorandums of understanding with our local bus service known as GET, and also with the superintendent of schools, because the superintendent of schools has the largest accessible fleet in the county. For most of our events, we are able to get by with our Kern Regional Transit, but it's good to have backup to know that we have more resources if we need them. Another thing I'd like to mention to you, and especially in Kern County, if we are dealing with fire, once you have an evacuation order, that is a lawful order for law enforcement to close a road, and entering into an area under evacuation can be problematic and tricky. And we are not going to send drivers into an area where they could be endangered by flame. So I would very much recommend again that if you receive an evacuation warning, that is the time to take action. You have time to coordinate with your group, and we know that we can get the drivers to you to help pick you up without endangering those drivers themselves. Now, on our transportation services, you can bring your companion animals. They ask that the cats be in a kennel, the dogs be on a leash. Obviously, service animals are always welcome. We have drilled very much into the county system that the service animal remains with their owner and has the same legal rights as their owner, and they are not to be separated under any circumstances. We have pushed very hard for staff at the shelters and throughout our process to know the only legal questions that can be asked to determine if it is a service animal. And I would also recommend that anyone who uses a service animal very clearly understand their rights. So if there are any problems with perhaps less experienced shelter staff questioning that, you know where you stand. And if you get any pushback, you immediately ask to speak to a supervisor who most likely would understand the situation better. Wanted to mention a couple of things about sheltering. We've done a lot of work in Kern County to make sure that our shelters address access and functional needs. And we've added additional protocols and equipment into our shelter trailers. We maintain additional lighting for those with low vision who may need night lighting. We've directed that shelter staff provide a verbal orientation to any to the shelter layout, to any rules, regulations, whatever it is that would be written and posted will be in large font. But if that is not sufficient, that shelter staff will provide verbal orientation. We know that in a shelter, oftentimes things are moved around as the situation grows. So we've also given very specific directions that the cot placement for people who have low vision or who are blind always be placed next to a permanent fixture, a pillar, a wall, with clear access to restrooms and to the eating facilities. I have to say, I also admire Vance. I get a lot of guidance from him. But as an emergency manager, I really appreciate the advocacy of what this council is doing. Sometimes when I'm speaking, I need to make sure that people understand I do not consider myself a subject matter expert. I rely on the subject matter experts, on the Vance Taylors, on the independent living centers, on the councils. Your advocacy to make sure that your needs are recognized and known by your local emergency managers is critical to the success of their ability to build the plans that will meet the barriers that you may encounter. Because most emergency managers are not living your life. They may not be aware of the things that can happen that can complicate things for you, and they can't begin to address them unless they are made aware of them. So your advocacy to your emergency management to be very clear and very direct, this is what I need, these are my gaps, how are you going to address them, gives them the baseline for moving forward to try and find solutions. So in Kern County, we do have a system set up. As most of our evacuations have been in our smaller areas, in our mountains, where mostly due to wildfires, we've been able to pull this off very successfully.
Okay, thank you. So, Jennifer or Vance, did either one of you want to add anything on this question before we turn to my final question for the day?
Hey, Jeff, it's Vance. So just a few things. Apologies, I didn't turn my camera on earlier. But it's on now. There we go. I think Georgiana and Jackie hit the nail on the head. I will say just maybe a few things. One is to continue to emphasize the importance of an AFN advisory committee. Right. That's the opportunity that emergency management has to really partner with the whole community. It's in that arena that people are able to understand each other's needs, right? That people are able to advocate for their needs and where we can move away from having our plan for the community as written by emergency managers in a vacuum, to having our plan of the community as written by the community. It's a huge difference, right? Planning for people instead of planning with people. Specifically on the evacuation side, jurisdictions need to stretch. One of the things they need to do is really make sure that there's a standardized operating procedure in place, because so many communities have this notion that, hey, we've got a plan in place for people to secure, let's say, accessible transportation services. But if the end user doesn't know how to access those plans or resources, then it really doesn't serve them. And oftentimes, we find jurisdictions do this thing where, hey, for this wildfire, call this phone number if you need help. But then there's a flood, and they say, if you need help, call this number, and it's a different number. Or it's a different wildfire, and so now we've got a new number. And so as a community, we're not really sure what number do we dial, so we end up calling 911, which, as Georgiana said, is not what we want people to do. So if communities would commit to having a single number that can be utilized, they'll do really well. Kern County is, I think, a great example of that. It's consistent. It's socialized through the community. And so people know exactly what to do and where to go to access support. We also want to see jurisdictions have more signed agreements with accessible transportation providers, not just in the jurisdiction, but in surrounding jurisdictions. And those really need to ensure that service can be provided 24/7, that they're going to provide taxi-like service, right, so on demand, and that they're going to be at no cost to the evacuees. The reality is that government needs to stretch. But I will also emphasize that as individuals, we need to stretch too. Right? I was at a meeting recently and I asked how many people are signed up to receive emergency alert warning and notification messages. And not a lot of hands went up. I asked, how many of you have a system in place where you've got maybe 4 or 5 people that you can call to support you during a disaster? Right? Recognizing that maybe not every one of them will be available, but that hopefully at least one of the 4 or 5 will be available. And not a lot of hands went up. And so as we start to ask these questions, it becomes really clear that we each have a different capability or capacity to prepare. But I think each of us can probably do more than what we're doing. And so as government stretches, as individuals stretch, and as community-based organizations and councils such as this one really work to promote a culture of preparedness, we find that we start to move the needle in significant ways. And that's where you end up really decreasing the level of human suffering that we see during events. That's, I think, how we reduce the number of lives lost during these events. And that's how we as a whole community come together, right? By trying to support individuals on a one-by-one basis. So thanks for the insights that have been provided, and thanks, Jeff, to you and the council for what you're doing. This is the type of partnership we need.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to ask one final question, and then I want to turn it over for questions from the audience. And this, these answers can be brief, every one of you has emphasized advocacy by the disability community. Some places have access and functional needs advisory committees, and many others don't. To any of you, what are your thoughts on some of the better ways that we can have our voices heard and advocate, especially at the local level?
This is Georgiana from Kern.
Go ahead.
I think it's a two-way street, because I think when, after Hurricane Katrina and the issue of access and functional needs started to become more relevant in emergency management circles, I think one of the big obstacles, at least in the early years, is that emergency managers didn't know how to develop this new group of stakeholders. Our usual stakeholders were fire and law and public works and public health, but this required us to reach out to the community to find the stakeholders who could give us the information we needed. I'm very lucky in Kern County to work with the Independent Living Center, who I could not function without. So we don't have an official council, but we work with the Independent Living Center and the Regional Center, and Be Glad. I didn't know the Council on the Blind had a chapter here in Bakersfield, and now that I know, I'm going to be reaching out next week to make some introductions, because I want to make sure we are coordinating with them as well. So I think that if there are organizations that could also reach out to their local emergency managers and say, I'd like to meet with you. I have concerns. I want to understand your plans for this. I want you to understand my perspective on X, Y, and Z. I think emergency managers would be very open and welcome to those contacts, because if they're not doing work on AFN, it's because they don't know where to go to get the subject matter expertise to bring policies and procedures to life.
Hey, anyone else?
This is Jackie Tamayo with County of Santa Clara. I would mm-hmm. also piggyback with what Georgiana said. We do have a very strong committee here in Santa Clara County that involves a lot of our larger organizations and even our smaller county community-based organizations. But we don't know everyone, because there's always new groups. And I think the problem with emergency management and access and functional needs and the policies is that emergency management has a history of thinking secondary of access and functional needs. And we have, since, as Georgiana said, since Katrina, it's became part of the forefront. So we have been educating our emergency managers within our county. So us as the county, we work with our cities to educate them on the essence of access and functional needs to be a forefront. And that comes a lot with working with our community-based organizations, our and our private NGOs. So we asked for those who would like to reach us, go and they're part of an organization, contact us. And if we're not there, we work directly with our ADA coordinators within the county. There's a disability council advisory group that we work closely with our office of, our county executive office, and reach out to us there. Because for emergency managers, we need to be present as much as we can in the community to make sure we're available and open to hear and to work with our community members. But also, don't feel that it's impossible to talk to us. Come and talk to us. We're here to do it, because as mentioned earlier, we can't prepare and plan, respond to recover without you. We can't plan for you without you. You're part of this, and we're a more resilient community with all of us together. So please shoot us the email and be a part of our group.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Jeff, this is Vance. I just wanted to say, we've got this Office of Access and Functional Needs within the Governor's Office of Emergency Services. But that didn't just happen because the governor woke up one day and thought, hey, there's a need for this, and here's how we'll move forward. This office exists because the community came together and advocated for it. And so that's the power that the community has. And we see that big change at the state level, but we also see it locally. And I think it's really important to note that in reaching out to emergency management agencies and partnering with them, it becomes really clear on the emergency management side that these community-based organizations bring a lot to the table, that they increase the bandwidth that an emergency management team has to identify and address considerations for the whole community. And so, you know, you can ask local emergency managers, say, would you like help assessing your shelters? Would you like support securing durable medical equipment or assistive devices? Are you interested in folks that can do a cop-by-cop assessment to identify and address needs? And it's like, yes, yes, yes. And would you like that for free? Yes. So that's when they really start to say, like, oh my gosh, not only is this a better way to serve our communities, right? That's more effective, but it also means we have bandwidth to then go do other things as well. And so we start to see CBOs as a force multiplier. If this group or any other group wants to get involved and they're having trouble connecting, I'm going to call my office. I'm happy to connect them with local emergency management agencies. We've got really good people that want to do really good things. And to the extent that we can help facilitate or empower that, that's a big part of why we exist.
Hey, thank you, Vance. So I'm going to turn it over to next. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is Georgiana. Could I just add one more thing?
Sure.
When we first started planning access and functional need response in Kern County, it was, you know, it was after Hurricane Katrina, and we had this big issue with a local dam, and we were doing evacuation planning. And way back when, I remember that several of my command staff, I worked for the fire department, they didn't understand why I was making such a fuss about this. They felt like, well, we've got this. We've got this. And I finally turned to one of them and I said, well, what do you all have in common sitting in the command staff at the fire department? You can all see, you can all hear, you can all walk, you can all swallow. You cannot understand. The world is not like you. And so I think if you are seeing that, and with that, and that I think was one of the early stumbling points, is that the people who were planning response, primarily the first responder community, didn't have the lived experience to say, oh, this is an issue, because it was never an issue for them or anyone they were surrounded by. And once we got into this and the issues started coming forward and they started to see the gaps and understand that, you know, the all-powerful sheriff and fire by themselves could not address this, I think it opened up the door more for being very receptive to getting that exactly that kind of input that Vance was talking about. So I'm hoping we've made a lot more progress statewide, and I know that Vance has been working on this, but I cannot overemphasize that emergency managers cannot do this without the input and involvement of the community. You have the lived experience that we may not have, and we cannot identify the barriers that come with your lived experience without your input and your guidance.
Okay, sorry, I had to stop a phone from ringing. One of the problems with Zoom, right? So I'm going to turn it over now to our fantastic host, Natalie, to see if we have any hands raised, and we'll take one from Natalie, and then if we have an email one, we'll take that one from Steve. So.
All right. Hi there, Natalie. Excuse me. You do have one hand, and you have Robert Acosta, and you are unmuted. You can go ahead.
Okay.
Or at least he said he's unmuted. I mean, yeah. You can speak, Robert. We are not hearing you. You have just muted yourself. You are unmuted.
Do you hear me now?
Yes. Yep.
Thank you. I live in Los Angeles County, but I'm quickly moving to Kern County. I don't know. I know you're mentioning emergency management. I pinned in on that. Where do I call to register? And I may have missed it. Do I call the fire department? Say, I'm a blind guy here. Help me out. And they'll say, well, we can walk and see and all that. But firemen are the best, by the way. They've come to our home often, not for fires. But so where do we start? Do I go to my city councilman and say, where is the emergency manager? I'd like to meet him or meet. I think it's wonderful. One more point. I'll be quick. I think it's wonderful that in Kern County, you get a human being that calls you and comes and evaluates you. Nobody does that here in LA. They say, sorry, or you get a robot that doesn't even know you're blind. Thank you. I hope you got my question. Where do we go?
So I'll start. Robert, that's my hometown. I'm a Los Angeles native as well. So okay. I feel you. So depending on your jurisdiction, I would go to your city.
I live in Chatsworth.
So city of Los Angeles, that's my hometown. the Office of Emergency Management actually does have a DAFN coordinator. So I could email Jeff the website, but you can sign up for Ready LA. That's their alert and warning system, first and foremost. And I can't speak on the behalf of everything that they are doing now because I've left EMD for approximately 4 years, but they do have a group and a committee that does work together to make sure that there is strategies in place, including a transportation mutual aid agreement that includes paratransit. So they use 311 for information. Mm-hmm. But I could send to this group the link to get you the up-to-date information. So I don't want to speak on behalf of them tremendously. But first and foremost, please register for Ready LA. I'm sorry, Notify LA, and then LA County has their alert and warning system also. And City of Los Angeles Emergency Management Department is pretty active, and they do have a community preparedness and engagement program that does go out. So I would like to, if we can provide that link, and so you can share it with the team.
Thank you. 10 years ago, one of our past presidents, who I would imagine is perhaps on this call, Donna Pomerantz, was very active in LA County's emergency preparedness team. And if we don't have anybody on their Access and Functional Needs Advisory Council, you guys in LA County better get on the ball.
Yeah. We can take one email if it came in, and then we're going to have to, for the sake of time, move on.
We have no email questions right now.
Okay. And that was only one hand.
Do you have a hand?
You have another hand in Zoom. Do you want that?
Yes. We have time for that, Regina.
Quickly, dear, whoever it is.
It is Frank Welty, and you can go ahead and unmute.
Well, I really enjoyed this panel. You know, every emergency is an opportunity for lessons to be learned. So I'm going to ask the panelists very quickly, what do you think was the big lesson about people with AFN, access and functional needs, that we learned from this year's LA fires?
I think that was a tough one to pin down. We learned a lot. We really need to do a thorough job of pulling back all those layers. I think just at the outset, you know, we've made so much progress on this issue in California that sometimes you hear people talk as though, you know, we're there, right? And I'm always really quick to say we're not, right? We've not yet arrived. And I think this was a very stark reminder. There continues to be a disproportionate impact. on people with access and functional needs every time there's a disaster. And this was no different. And so if we're looking at alerting and getting accessible messages to people, we need to do better. If we're talking about how do we make sure people can evacuate safely, we need to do better. How do we make sure that shelters have all the resources that they need to serve everybody? We need to do better. And now as we look at recovery and things like affordable, accessible housing, we need to do better. So this is one we're going to really have to unpack. We will learn from it. We will continue to improve. And it's going to take a whole of community effort to get there.
Thank you, Rance. And we have a hard stop at 4 o'clock. So I really appreciate you, Georgiana, Jennifer, and see, I'm not looking at my program. Jackie, you come and spend some time with us and answer our questions and empower us. I want to thank you for the encouragement that you've given us on advocacy. All right. We have some business to take care of, and then we have some door prizes and a couple of more of those chapter of the year submissions, but an important announcement. And please, if you're going to leave, at least stay for a second. We are starting at 7 p.m. and going straight to our elections tonight. So we are starting at 7 p.m. and we will be moving right into our elections tonight. So spread the word. I'm sure there'll be emails and so forth, but sometimes our grapevine works a little better than email. So go ahead and spread that word that it's 7 o'clock tonight and not 6. So that's very important. But let's, Lisa has been patiently waiting. We're going to have a door prize and hear two of our chapter of the year submissions and another door prize. So stick around, Lisa. Take it away. Lisa.
One second. Just a moment. Sorry. I just saw her hand go up. Just a second.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Lisa, you should be able to unmute.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Great presentations and congratulations to this afternoon's award winners. Very well deserved. So let's give away some money here. And I'm hoping that the volume is going to be good for everybody. I took your advice, Larry, and switched up my settings. So let's see how this works. So first off is we're going to do a $25 gift card to Target from the Bayview chapter. So let's get this wheel shuffled really good. And let's give it a spin.
No. Da 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 da. We don't hear the music.
We hear you, but we don't hear the wheel, Lisa.
So you didn't hear the music at all?
No.
No.
Huh.
It's okay. Let's give it out anyway.
Yeah. I'm wondering if it's because we're in a webinar, but we'll try to make some adjustments. So the winner is Patricia Nash. Oh, congratulations, Patty.
Yay, we'll get that to you. Okay, let's go on to our chapter of the year because I know we're going close. We'll play 2 and 3 if you're there, John.
Okay, you want to just back to back, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, here's number 2.
Hi, this is Penny Valdivinos, the president of CCCLV, California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. We have worked hard in doing a new constitution, getting it updated and granted since Bernice has passed. We have a Sunday chat on the 2nd and 4th Sundays of the month. We also have
membership meetings monthly. We like to hear from everyone, and we wanted everyone to know that anyone that is totally blind now that has proceeded from being low vision is welcome. Even totally blind people are welcome. We value all their input in all our meetings. And we meet on the first Monday of the month at 6 o'clock.
Good evening, and what a lovely day this is. My name is Andre Green. I am the president of the Glendale Burbank chapter. There's some exciting things we're going to be putting in place moving forward. And I'm just hoping that I get your support, love, and understanding as we move forward in the 2025 calendar year. You know, some of the things we initiated when we have this You Can Give, where we're reaching out to other blind individuals who have broken canes, unwanted canes, unused canes, and even new canes that we can give out to those outside of our country who can't afford or can use and are in need of canes. So it's a You Can Give. A friend of mine has, he's also blind, out of Tennessee, who has opportunity to take canes to other countries for those that are blind and are in need of canes. We mail all those canes out to him. He fixes them and repairs them with his other team, and we're allowed to give back what was so freely given to us, because those canes in other countries are extremely expensive. So that's one of the things we've done. We're trying to incorporate other new members so that we can get more active in our community. It's important that we continue to give back to what was freely given to us. That's this new way of life. And other things we've done is trying to do socials where we can get out more. Although the pandemic did slow us all down, but yet we are fighters. We're go-getters. So we're encouraging others to come and join us in some of the social events we have near and far. We had an amazing Christmas party last year in December, and it was so exciting, and we had so much fun. Everyone left with a gift, just to name a few things we gave away. We also had meal giveaways where some people won raffles where they didn't even have to pay for their meal. So that was exciting. Everyone enjoyed themselves. And so that's why I'm just elated that I'm the president, and I'm looking forward to meeting all of you in this 2025 calendar year.
Thank you. Excellente. Okay, we got that wheel ready again, Lisa.
1 second. Sorry.
She's got to do one more door prize.
Okay, Lisa, go ahead.
Or two if you have them.
I have one. I have two. It's your call. How many we're doing, Regina?
We have time for two.
Okay. So we're going to do $25 gift card to Starbucks from GSGDHI.
Okay,
so let me see. I switched it up. Let's see if we can hear it here. I'm not sure.
No, we'll figure it out by next time.
Still no?
No.
Oh, no. Okay, I think I'm going to have to work off two computers tonight. The winner is Catherine Fancher. Congratulations, Catherine.
Congratulations. And one more very quickly. Let's go.
And one more. Okay. So $25 gift card to, hold on, my list just went away. $25 gift card to Amazon. From the Fresno chapter.
Okay. Here we go. That wheel spinning.
And the winner is Vita Zavalli.
Vita Zavalli. Yay. Maybe you can tell her, Frank, if she's not on the call. All right. Don't forget, 7 o'clock tonight. 7 o'clock, guys. So spread the word. Thank you for being wonderful participants. This was a great group of panelists and presentations. And thank you, Natalie, for hosting. Thank you, John, for playing the files. And were you streaming too, John?
Yes, still am. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. We appreciate you. And come back. There's lots more of our wonderful CCB convention 2025.